Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's four-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we'll hear the first of three talks on the year 1863. Our guest speaker will be Mark Scherer, associate professor and chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of his presentation will be The Path to Gettysburg. Dr. Scherer's lecture will focus on the events of early 1863 that culminated in the watershed battle of the war at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. He'll include a discussion of the initial effects of the Emancipation Proclamation that went into effect on January 1st, and the political, cultural, diplomatic, and military dynamics that led to the epic clash at Gettysburg. Dr. Scherer will conclude with a brief examination of the battle itself and its lasting significance in American history. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 30th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Mick Hale, Director of Education at the Durham Museum.
Dr. Scherer is a chair of the History Department at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, as well as a professor of history. His first presentation did an outstanding job, had about 60 or so folks, so we've got a great crowd here tonight to take part in this discussion. We will have some Q&A following, and we will have folks working through the audience with microphones to aid in that. So with that, again, thank you very much for coming out tonight, and I present Dr. Mark Scherer.
Well, thank you very much, Mick, and I want to thank the rest of the staff here at the Durham for inviting me to take part in these sessions. As Mick indicated, the first one was a lot of fun. I hope this one will be a lot of fun as well. I'm really impressed with the turnout. I suspect that many of you thought you were going to see a movie or something. I don't have a movie for you, but normally I don't get a crowd this big unless they have to be here because they're my students. So it's wonderful. It really is a joy and a great treat to be able to talk to so many volunteers, as it were, people who come because they're interested in the topics that we'll be talking about. As you know, I've been asked to speak about the Civil War in general and the year 1863 in particular. And I think that obviously 1863 is a timely topic, living as we are in the 150th anniversary year of that, a very dramatic year of 1863. But I also really do think that the year 1863 is a fascinating topic to discuss, to analyze, to remind ourselves about at any time, any place. Even aside from the sesquicentennial commemoration, because I really do believe that 1863 is the most significant, the most pivotal, the most decisive, the most determinative. I mean, you can pick your own adjective here. There are an awful lot of them that apply. But 1863 is a key watershed year in American history. And that's the most fundamental point that I want to make here tonight. I think it's the ongoing theme that my colleague Dr. Danielle Battisti and I will continue to present over the rest of these sessions throughout the year. It's almost like a syllogism, if you will. You know, if A, then B, if B, then C, and therefore if A, then C. Here's what I'm getting at. If we accept the premise, as I do, that the Civil War is the defining event in American history, and if we accept the second premise, that 1863 marks the critical watershed year in the Civil War, then I think we are inevitably led to the conclusion that 1863 must be one of the most significant years in this nation's history. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. I want to try to bring you along as I try to defend that rather bold statement here tonight. Now, obviously, our time is limited. Your patience has limits as well. My voice has limits. And so while there are hundreds of things we could talk about during 1863, I think the reality is that we need to limit ourselves a bit. And so what I'm going to be doing tonight is really focusing on two main storylines of the year that I think give it its transformative drama, if you will. The first story we want to talk about is the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation and its dramatic impact, both on the war itself and on this nation's much broader and ongoing history. And then, of course, the second storyline, the one that we'll get to at the end, probably the one that drew most of you here, I suppose, and rightfully so, will be probably briefer than some of you would like, probably longer than some of you would like, look at the epic Battle of Gettysburg. So that's where we're headed. That's the roadmap. But we need to begin with context. I've seen a couple of my students out there in the room. I suspect you're rolling your eyes at this point because here's Shear going off on context again. I firmly believe that context is everything in historical analysis and interpretation. We can't understand our history. We can't understand where we are today as a nation without understanding where we have been together in the past. Context is everything. That's one of my guiding mantras in every classroom that I enter. And so if I can hope to convince you of the transformative effects of 1863, if we can seek to appreciate 1863 as a year of change, then I think we need to begin with the question, change from what? And that requires us to look at late 1862. Where did things stand as of late 1862? What was the mood of the country, for lack of a better phrase, as of late 1862? And when we look at, and again, try to encapsulate the essence of what's going on in late 1862, it really comes down to one word. I mean, again, there are a lot of adjectives that can apply, but I'll choose this one. The outlook is dismal. It's a gloomy time in American history. And that's the case, really, for both sides of the ongoing war. Both the Confederacy and the federal government are feeling the pain of what has become a much longer war than either side had anticipated. But as we look at the dismal outlook in 1862, we can quickly take a stab at establishing a kind of a military posture of the opposing sides at the outset of the year. We can talk about public opinion, morale, support for the war. We can talk about the very messy, very troublesome, very complex politics of the period. So that's going to be our starting point here. A quick look at context. And we'll begin with the military dynamics. When military historians talk about the military events of the Civil War, we tend to think in terms, we talk in terms of the Western theater and the Eastern theater. When we talk about the Western theater, we're talking about Kentucky, we're talking Tennessee, we're talking parts of Arkansas, parts of Missouri, we're talking about the upper Mississippi River Basin. And the point that I want to make here is that by late 1862, in some significant military ways, the Union really holds the upper hand. Union forces and armies under the command, the collective command, the supreme command of Ulysses S. Grant, but aided by a corps of very able field subordinates, William Sherman, William Rosecrans, and others, have made significant headway. Grant has won a narrow but very costly victory at Shiloh in the spring of 62. In late 62, Union forces managed to capture Corinth in northern Mississippi, and they've made significant progress in moving down the Mississippi Valley toward their ultimate goal of taking complete control of the Mississippi Valley. Meanwhile, Union naval forces have recaptured New Orleans and are beginning to make some progress in pushing northward up the Mississippi Valley. And again, they're making significant headway in terms of their ultimate strategic goal of capturing the entire Mississippi Valley. But despite those successes, modest as they are, costly though they may be, there's still no end in sight. It's still going to be a long, bloody, drawn-out affair to reach those goals. Meanwhile, back east, we see a very different story. From the outset of the war, the primary objective of Union armies in the East had been to march the relatively short distance from Washington, D.C. to the Confederate capital, Richmond, take the Confederate capital, disperse the Confederate government, win the war. And so the mantra from the beginning is on to Richmond, as this recruiting and morale-boosting broadside suggests. And so a good deal of the fighting, particularly in the first 2 years of the war in the Eastern Theater, is fought in this relatively small area between the two respective capitals, Washington, D.C. here, Richmond, Virginia, about 90 miles to the south here. We've seen very little progress. Repeatedly, during the first 18 months of the fighting, repeatedly, Union forces have attempted to traverse that ground between Washington and Richmond, only to be turned back time after time after time. The very broad and overly simplistic story that emerges here is one of superior military leadership on the side of the Confederates in the Eastern Theater. We begin, of course, with the most famous of all the Confederate leaders, Robert E. Lee. But Lee, of course, is supported by a very able, very even brilliant field team of field commanders. His most famous subordinate, Thomas Stonewall Jackson. You see James Longstreet, Joe Johnston, Pierre Beauregard, Albert Sidney Johnston, Jeb Stuart, Lee's flamboyant and colorful and famous cavalry leader, and even figures like the infamous Nathan Bedford Forrest, who will go on, of course, to infamy as one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan in the post-war period. Against this cadre of Confederate leadership, Lincoln is searching with increasing frustration and increasing futility to find a field commander that can match Lee and his subordinates. What I call Lincoln's parade of generals that you see here, I mean, I always say this would be almost comical if the results and the consequences weren't so tragic. But in the first 18 months of the fighting, Lincoln has replaced his supreme commander of the Army of the Potomac, the main fighting force in the Eastern Theater, on six different occasions. And so we wind up with a litany of failed generals that begins with Irvin McDowell, who is defeated in humiliating fashion at First Bull Run in the summer of 61. Lincoln turns to George McClellan. We could spend the rest of this session talking about the relationship between Lincoln and McClellan. It's a fascinating story to tell, but McClellan is ultimately relieved after his failure in the Peninsular Campaign in the spring of 62. Lincoln turns to John Pope. Pope, once again, tries to march on Richmond. He is turned back at Second Bull Run. Lincoln, in complete frustration, now feels that he has no choice but to turn back to George McClellan. McClellan then wins a narrow victory at Antietam in September of 62, but fails to follow up as aggressively as Lincoln would like, and so he is relieved of command for the second and final time. Lincoln turns to Ambrose Burnside. Burnside fails in unbelievably bloody humiliation at Fredericksburg. Burnside is replaced by Joe Hooker. Hooker is defeated by Lee at Chancellorsville. Hooker ultimately resigns. Lincoln turns to George Meade, and it will, of course, be George Meade who is in command of Union forces when we get to Gettysburg. That's the parade of generals. It's a reflection of Lincoln's continuing frustration to make much headway in the Eastern theater of the war. Going on to the social and cultural context of the time, this is pretty easy, quick stuff. We don't need to spend much time here. We don't have time to do much with this. But let me just suggest to you that by late 1862, as a result of the continuous defeats in the East, public support for the war is waning rapidly. Lincoln's own popularity and political credibility is dissipating quickly as well. Support for war, as I say, is down. Recruitment and enlistments into the Union military forces are down as well. What we find is a kind of what I've called here, not altogether adequately, I've kind of characterized as a mood of uncertainty and tension, angst, if you will, throughout the North and in many sectors of the South as well. Finally, let's take a quick look at the political context as it exists in late 1862. Lincoln is juggling as fast as he can. He is being attacked scathingly in many cases by critics from virtually every direction of the political compass, the political spectrum. He has his natural antagonists and critics within the rival Democratic Party. Of particular concern are the activities of the so-called Copperheads. The Copperheads was the pejorative term used to describe Northern Democrats who supported the Southern war effort. So he's got to deal with them. Just as problematically, if not more so, for Lincoln are problems within his own Republican Party. From the outset of the war, there's been a faction of Republicans. They become known ultimately as the Radical Republicans, who believe that Lincoln is not prosecuting the war for the right reasons. He is not prosecuting the war aggressively enough. His attitude, his war policy, is not punitive enough. These abolitionists and radical Republicans want the war to be fought for something more than simply preservation of the Union. They want Lincoln to do more to attack what they believe is the real cause of the war. And they're accurate, they're correct in this regard, slavery. And so Lincoln is suffering all sorts of criticism from these members of his own party. And then, of course, there are the border states to take into account. Throughout the war, Lincoln is struggling to find policies, to find ways to keep the border states with the federal government. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with that phrase, border state refers to those four states, Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, Delaware, where slavery had been permitted before the war in the antebellum period and continued during the war. But these states had not joined the Confederacy. They had not seceded from the Union. And Lincoln is bound and determined, for a variety of reasons, to keep those border states in the Union, to not allow them to slip away as well. And so he has to fashion his policies, he has to fashion his words and his actions in such a way as to accommodate those border state interests as well. All of that's backdrop. All of that is backstory. Now we get into the meat of this presentation. January 1st, 1863. The Emancipation Proclamation goes into effect, and what I call the year of change begins. We begin to see the momentum of the war change for a variety of different reasons. But first, foremost, and always, we need to understand that the Emancipation Proclamation that goes into effect on January 1st, 1863, is one of the most significant events in all of American history. I can't make that point strongly enough. I'd be more than happy to just talk about the Emancipation Proclamation for the next 20 minutes and let you all go home. But we want to get to other stories as well. But bear with me here, because again, context is important. So we need to remind ourselves very quickly of the backstory to January 1st, 1863, as it relates to the Emancipation Proclamation. You may recall, if you came to Dr. Davis's presentations last year, commemorating the events of 1862, you might be aware of the fact that on September 22nd, 1862, in the aftermath of the Union victory at Antietam, Lincoln had issued what we refer to as his preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. It was, in essence, a 100-day warning. He tells the Confederate states that if they do not come back to the Union by January 1st, 1863, then on that date, he, Lincoln, will proclaim all slaves still held in those rebellious states to be thenceforth and forever free. Lincoln issues the warning on September 22nd. Predictably, the Confederate states simply ignore the decree. It really is an empty gesture as far as they're concerned. And many folks in the North believe that when push came to shove, Lincoln would probably back away. January 1st comes, and Lincoln doesn't back away. He follows through. Late in the afternoon of January 1st, 1863, he puts his hand to the document, and he frees the slaves. That's the way the story is typically told. He frees the slaves. But I suspect that many of you in this audience know where I'm headed with this. There's an oddness, if you will, to the language of the Emancipation Proclamation. Some would say it's more than oddness. Some would say that it's hypocrisy. What I'm getting at here is that when we look at the language of the Emancipation Proclamation, you don't have to be an historian by any means to understand that what Lincoln is doing is freeing the slaves only in those states that remain in rebellion against the federal government. In other words, he is purporting to free the slaves only in those areas that he has no effective control over, which is a very odd thing indeed, don't you think? But he's saying that he's freeing the slaves only in those states or designated parts of states where the people thereof shall be in rebellion against the United States. Those are the ones that are free, specifically exempted from the effects of the decree, are lots of other enslaved people, specifically those slaves still held in Missouri, Kentucky, Delaware, Maryland, the border states. But you can see here there are some other areas that are also exempted from the coverage. New Orleans and the surrounding parishes there. Slaves could still be held in those areas that the Union had retaken control of. Tennessee, the same way. The Union controls almost all of Tennessee by that time, and so Tennessee is exempted from the provisions of the decree. And so we're left with the issue of trying to make sense out of what appears to be a kind of ridiculous gesture on Lincoln's part. How do we explain what he's doing here? I like to describe what Lincoln's doing here as kind of troublingly brilliant, if you will. It's a testament to Lincoln's political gifts. It's a reflection of all of these factors that he's trying to juggle and to take into account together. How do we explain what he's doing here? We can begin with Lincoln's reading of the Constitution. Lincoln is a lawyer. He's a constitutional expert. He studied the Constitution all of his professional life. Lincoln understands, and Lincoln has said for the better part of 20 years, that no president, himself included, has the authority under the Constitution to unilaterally abolish slavery. Lincoln would have liked to have done that. Most Lincoln sympathizers would agree, myself included. I think Lincoln would have liked to have done that, but he simply can't. Whether we want to acknowledge this or not, the sad truth is, folks, that the United States Constitution, as it existed in 1863, protects slavery. It accommodates slavery in at least four separate spots. The Founding Fathers at Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 made room for slavery. That is a stain on the national soul that we had grappled with for, as Lincoln will later remind us, 87 years, 87 years. And so Lincoln, again, to get back to the point here, even if Lincoln had wanted to free all the slaves, he believed that as a constitutional matter, he could not do so. But, Lincoln is a constitutional scholar. He's an expert in the Constitution. He's able to interpret the Constitution in defensible and plausible ways. And so he finds, in September of 62, he finds a way to accomplish much of what he's trying to accomplish, freeing the slaves. But he does it through another route. He says that as commander-in-chief of American armed forces, the president does have the power to take measures that might otherwise be unconstitutional as a matter of wartime exigency, as a matter of wartime necessity. And so Lincoln says, as commander-in-chief, he is freeing the slaves to weaken the Confederate war effort. And again, you can look to the language of the transcript of the Emancipation Proclamation that you provided, and you can find several places where he reiterates that military justification for what he's doing. And again, keep in mind the border state dynamics. Lincoln knows that if he had attempted to free all the slaves, including those slaves in the border states, as of January 1st, 1863, that is very likely to offend the sensibilities of slave interest in those states. It's probably going to drive them into the arms of the Confederacy. It is going to have a boomerang effect, I suppose you could say, in terms of advancing the Union war effort. With all that in mind, then, we wind up with this rather, again, odd, constrained, tortured sort of instrument. And there's one final thing. I'm sorry, I forgot about this one. Diplomatic considerations. Very quickly. Throughout the war, one of the most cherished goals of the Confederacy was to gain formal diplomatic recognition from the British Empire and other European powers of the day. The Confederates, that was one of the things they were always banking on, that the Brits would need Southern cotton to such a degree that they would come into the war on the side of the Confederacy. Lincoln is always trying to manipulate his foreign policy so as to keep that from happening. It's another layer of his juggling act. The point here is that Lincoln takes the step to solidify the Union position vis-a-vis European attitudes and outlook. Lincoln knows that if he transforms the war, as we're going to talk about this transformative effect of the decree here in a moment, but Lincoln knows that if he begins to shift the focus of the war toward this issue of slavery, that's going to make it that much more difficult for the Brits or any of the other European powers to come into the war on the side of the Confederacy. All right. Another one of my mantras for my students. You got to be able to answer the all-important who cares question. When you're talking about any sort of historical event, when you're trying to analyze history, who cares? Who cares? If the Emancipation Proclamation didn't free a single slave at the time that it went into effect, as thousands of historians have pointed out, the Emancipation Proclamation did not free a single slave. And yet, we think of Lincoln as the great emancipator. We celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation, as I'm doing here, as this great document of liberation. Why do we care about it? What impact does it actually have? What I want you guys to understand, or what I would like to convince you of, is that the Emancipation Proclamation fundamentally transforms the nature of the war. It is accurate as far as this point goes. It is accurate to say that not a single slave was freed immediately by Lincoln's signing of that famous document. That's true. Well, there are some exceptions to that. But for our purposes, that's true enough. But what I want you to understand is that what the Emancipation Proclamation assures is that as the war goes on, and as the combined weight of Union military and industrial strength ultimately and inexorably overwhelms the Confederacy, 4 million Americans will be freed forever from captivity. And we don't have to go any farther than that, folks, to understand the monumental impact of this instrument. Beyond that short-term impact. At the broader level, the Emancipation Proclamation transforms the nation. We are a nation that, again, from the get-go, had been plagued by this original sin. Four generations of American leaders had tried to grapple with, tried to come to terms with this issue. Time after time after time, we found a way. Between 1787 and 1863, we found a way to dance around the issue, to compromise it away, to shove it under the rug, to leave it for another generation to deal with. And now, finally, we are brought face to face with this great moral dilemma. It is the great contradiction, it is the great paradox of American history, that a nation founded on a principle, an idea, verbalized most eloquently, of course, by Mr. Jefferson, that all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How can we square the fact that a nation founded on that idea remains, in the mid-19th century, one of the few developed nations in the world where human slavery still existed? By confronting the issue finally in 1863, the nation will be forever changed. Those 4 million slaves will eventually be forever free. One final tangible impact of it And again, you can look to the language of the decree that you have in front of you. The Emancipation Proclamation also specifically authorizes and encourages the recruitment and enlistment of African American soldiers into the Union armies. And as the war goes on, Black Americans will flock to that call. Ultimately, almost 180,000 Black men and women will serve in Union forces during the Civil War. They will suffer casualty rates about twice that of white regiments in the Union armies, for reasons that we can go into later if we have time. Make no mistake about it, folks, the enlistment of almost 200,000 African-American troops will play a pivotal role in the later campaigns that ultimately bring the war to a successful conclusion for the Union. All right, Gettysburg. To tell the Gettysburg story, especially in the time that I have left, we need to begin in late 1862. I want to take you back to Fredericksburg, December 1862. In December of 62, Ambrose Burnside, in command of the Army of the Potomac, leads his forces down out of Washington. They cross the Rappahannock River, and Burnside orders his forces to make a unbelievably foolish frontal assault against Confederate lines on elevated ground across the river. It's absolute carnage. Mindless bloodletting. Burnside pulls back across the river once again in humiliating defeat, which sets us up for a similar exercise in futility about 6 months later, in early May of 1863. Burnside, as we saw before, has been replaced by Joe Hooker. Hooker brings the Army of the Potomac once again out of Washington. Once again, he's heading for Richmond. And once again, he crosses the Rappahannock River to engage Bob Lee and his forces near Chancellorsville, Virginia. Chancellorsville is an extremely complex battle. It's a tough one to summarize with any kind of economy here. But suffice to say that Hooker has about half again as many available troops under his command at Chancellorsville than Lee does. Lee faces what could have been a potentially nightmare scenario. Lee engages in what most military historians believe to be his most brilliant tactical operation at Chancellorsville. He divides his forces in the face of a superior enemy. That goes against conventional military wisdom. Bottom line, Lee counterattacks Hooker at three different places, ultimately driving Hooker's forces once again back across the river. And in the aftermath of Fredericksburg, followed by the additional Union humiliation for Hooker and his forces at Chancellorsville, Bob Lee and the Confederate leadership are at the very apex of their power. They are at the height of their tactical and strategic success. And so, shortly after Chancellorsville, the Confederate leadership, Lee, Jefferson Davis, the rest of the Confederate leadership, decide on a rather bold gamble. For the second time in the war, they're going to abandon what had been their strategy of basically fighting a defensive war, and for the second time in the war, they're going to head north. Confederate forces are going to invade Northern Territory. Their motives are multi-layered. Again, historians were disciples of multiple causation. There's always multiple things at work here, and I don't have time to bore you with all the details, but they're driven by a number of different factors. Part of it is economic. They simply want to basically work off of northern resources for a while in the summer of 63, make the northern population feel the pain, feel the cost of the war. His soldiers are low on food, they're low on supplies, they're low on shoes, blankets. Let's go north and take them while we have the opportunity. So that's part of it. There are military dynamics at work here as well. Again, Lee has proven himself time and time again to be superior to the best of what the Union Army has to offer. He believes that if he moves north into Union territory, if perhaps he can pose a significant threat to the federal capital at Washington, this will force Lincoln to bring some of those forces back from the Western theater, relieve some of the pressure on Vicksburg, help to alleviate Confederate military concerns in the West. So that's part of what's going on militarily. Again, there are diplomatic considerations at work here as well. The Confederacy continues to angle forward, continues to maneuver for diplomatic recognition from the British Empire. Lee and Davis believe that if they can pose a real, tangible threat to Washington, D.C., if they can, again, win major victories in Union territory, certainly this will bring the Brits into the war on their side, force the Brits to give them diplomatic recognition. And so, as we move into June of 1863, Lee's forces begin to advance northward. Because he is moving some 50,000 troops into Union territory, because they are essentially living off the land, he's going to have to divide his forces once again. They're actually going to move up into Maryland and then on into Pennsylvania in several staggered columns. But essentially, they're going to follow this route here, moving north through Maryland and up into Pennsylvania. Lee is actually just, his forces are foraging as they go. He may have an ambition to attack and take Harrisburg, the Pennsylvania capital. He might move on and move toward Philadelphia. He might loop down and pose a threat to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, the Union Army, ultimately commanded by George Meade, will be moving in this direction here. Again, they're trying to sort of track or shadow Lee's advance on the eastern flank. And most importantly, Meade is trying to maintain his presence between the Confederates and Washington, D.C. As these two large armies maneuver in the southern Pennsylvania countryside, advance scout teams from the Confederate side are moving down into the small town of Gettysburg in southern Pennsylvania, operating in that area June 29th, June 30th. On June 30th, Union recon teams operating in this area, in the same area, stumble on the Confederate scouts. Both recon teams send back word to their respective commands that they have engaged or made contact with the enemy. Neither side really knows for sure in those early hours of contact at Gettysburg, you know, what they're facing, how big their opposing forces are. It's kind of an accidental bumping into one another near this important crossroads town of Gettysburg in southern Pennsylvania. But Lee begins to consolidate all of his forces in southern Pennsylvania into the direction of Gettysburg. Meade begins to get word of a sizable Confederate army in that area. Union forces begin to collect and move in that area as well. And on July 1st, the largest land battle in the history of the Western Hemisphere will commence. This sounds very melodramatic. I'm almost ashamed to put it up there, and yet I'll sleep okay tonight, because I've always thought that if ever there was a moment in American history that deserves a little bit of melodrama, this is it. The fate of the nation really does hang in the balance as these two large armies come together at Gettysburg and fight this three-day battle. We'll make a few very broad-based points about the relative positions of the two armies at this point. The first day can be characterized by this label I've given it, bloody positioning. You know, there's some irony here in the fact that the Confederate forces, the Southern forces, are actually moving into Gettysburg from the north and from the west, while Union forces are defending from the south. So when we see here the red forces here, A.P. Hill and Ewell and Jubal Early and others are coming in. They're consolidating their forces. They're moving into to Gettysburg from this direction. Meanwhile, advance forces, really it's a very light Union force on the first day of the battle, actually light cavalry that are trying to engage in infantry maneuvers and kind of a holding mechanism here just outside of Gettysburg. Union forces are going to be arrayed out here, trying to hold back the advancing Confederate troops. As the day goes on, in bloody fighting, the two forces are going to be moved down through the city of Gettysburg. And by late afternoon, Union forces have withdrawn onto a series of hills located just to the south of Gettysburg. Now, the labeling here gets a little bit tricky. Students often get confused as we talk about it because on the one side of the town here, you've got something called Seminary Ridge, a low ridge of hills along the west and southern section of the town. And directly south, you have another line of hills called Cemetery Ridge. You've got several hills here, Cemetery Hill, Culp's Hill here, and then down at this end of this ridge line, you have two pronounced little mountains, hills, that have become legendary ever since in American military history as Little Round Top and Round Top. But at the end of the fighting, at the end of the day's fighting, July 1st, Union forces have taken the high ground here on Cemetery Hill. The Confederates will make several rather feeble and half-hearted efforts to drive the Union forces off of Cemetery Hill late in the day on July 1st. The bottom line is, and what you ought to understand here, is at the end of the first day, even though the Union has been driven back, even though Buford and the other commanders on the field at the first day have been driven back and they've had to give up the town itself, it can still be seen as a victory of sorts for the Union because they hold the high ground. They have not given up the strategic advantages associated with holding this high ground between Gettysburg and Washington, D.C., 100 miles to the south, 90 miles to the south. By July 2nd, both sides have reinforced. More troops from both sides have arrived on the scene. During the night of July 1st, morning of July 2nd, Meade has arrived on the scene. He gives orders for Union forces to entrench themselves along Cemetery Ridge. Meanwhile, Lee has arrayed his forces along Seminary Ridge, and they have encircled the Union lines here on Culp's Hill and Cemetery Hill. The bulk of the fighting on July 2nd, 1863, the second day of the battle, will be fought on the two flanks. The Confederate strategy, as I suspect many of you know, will be to turn the Union flanks, to envelop them on both ends, envelop and destroy. The fighting is brutal and bloody here on Culp's Hill. Ultimately, Ewell's forces will be turned back. Meanwhile, down here on the southern end of the Union lines, the fighting will be legendarily horrific on Little Round Top, Big Round Top, an area in front of the two hills called Devil's Den. There's a wheat field here, a peach orchard here. For some inexplicable, still unexplained reason, one of the Union commanders on that end, Dan Sickles, has moved his forces off the ridge line out here in front. Longstreet's forces are going to drive them back with devastating casualties through this portion of the day's fighting. All of which brings us to the decisive third day of the battle. Having failed to turn the Union ends, Lee decides, against the advice of some of his field commanders, including the very strongly worded recommendations of Pete Longstreet not to do this, Lee decides to put all of his eggs in one basket, for the most part, and concentrate all of his force on the third day of the battle on the center of the Union lines. Here. Those of you who know your Civil War history, know what happens on the afternoon of July 3rd, 1863. Pete Longstreet is the overall field commander for this sector of the fighting. Longstreet, again, is dead set against this maneuver, but Lee is insistent, and Longstreet orders his forces forward. George Pickett, a Virginia regiment commander, will be given the rather dubious honor of leading the charge against the center of the Union line. This becomes known ever since in American military history as Pickett's Charge. Pickett, by the way, was overjoyed with this opportunity. His forces have been held in reserve during the first 2 days of the fighting. He's eager to get in the fight. He will lead his forces in this direction here. What ensues will be, very literally, the high point of the Confederate military effort in the Civil War. Coming across about 1,000 yards of relatively open terrain, moving against a heavily fortified, deeply entrenched, elevated enemy, Pickett's forces, Pettigrew, Anderson's forces are absolutely devastated by the Union defenses here. Late in the afternoon, one of the Confederate generals, Lewis Armstead, manages with about 100 of his men to breach the Union lines. Armstead rallied his forces with his cap at the tip of his saber, leading his men across the Union line, but it's all for naught. Pickett's Charge is turned back. The Confederate Army suffers devastating, overwhelming casualties. Lee himself is distraught with what has occurred. As the battered stragglers from Pickett's regiment begin to stream back across the empty fields, General Lee meets them with tears in his eyes, saying, "It's all my fault, boys, it's all my fault." Again, the effects, the impact are hard to overstate. They're hard to exaggerate. Obviously, the Union victory at Gettysburg provides a boost to Union morale for the first time. Bob Lee has been defeated in a major engagement. Union forces have met and defeated the best and the brightest that the Confederacy has to offer. This is obviously going to result in an uptick in public support for the war effort, again, for the first time. I mean, Lee had amassed for himself an aura, a reputation of virtual infallibility, invincibility. It's the first time that we see a little blemish on that otherwise sterling military reputation. The defeat at Gettysburg ends once and for all any continuing Confederate hopes for diplomatic recognition and a possible military alliance with the British Empire or any other European nation. And of course, we really should have started with this when we talk about the impact, the casualties. We always need to think about in terms of the human cost. There's the numbers for you. 125,000 men total engaged in the fight. Over 50,000 total casualties in 3 days of fighting. Almost immediately after the battle, professional photographers arrived on the scene, Matthew Brady, Alexander Gardner, and others. They began to record the carnage. Long term, what can we say about the impact of Gettysburg? Again, we go back to the central theme of this presentation, the transformative effects of 1863. We talk about the ultimate legacy. Gettysburg, from a military perspective, is the definitive turning point in the war. The momentum begins to change. We can appreciate the dramatic turning point nature of the battle if we look at the what-ifs. if Armistead's breakthrough of the Union lines had prevailed, if he had been able to move in, consolidate, break through, envelop the Union forces, if the Union had been defeated at Gettysburg, there's virtually nothing that would have stopped Lee from advancing toward Washington. He could have put the Capitol at danger. He could have put the federal government to flight. He certainly would, at the very least, have been in a much better position to impose a negotiated peace on terms favorable to the Confederacy. We would likely have two nations today instead of one, and 4 million Americans would have remained in captivity. Vicksburg falls to Ulysses S. Grant just one day after the epic victory at Gettysburg, and when you combine Gettysburg with Vicksburg, the Confederacy will be put on the defensive for the duration of the war. They'll no longer be able to engage in offensive operations. This is the beginning of the end for the Confederacy. But much to Lincoln's deep chagrin and frustration, rather than following up aggressively to attack and envelop and deliver the killer blow to Lee as he lays vulnerable in southern Pennsylvania, Meade decides that he cannot and will not pursue, and to his, I mean, we've got to be fair to George Meade here, many military historians and many contemporary military observers understood and even agreed with Meade. His army had suffered staggering casualties in the previous 3 days fighting as well. He thought that he was in no position to pursue Lee. The point, however, is that Lee escapes once again. And while this is the beginning of the end, it is only that. There's still going to be 2 more years of bloodshed, 2 more years of social and political turmoil before the thing will be wrapped up. And that's in part what Danielle Battisti will be talking about in July and what I'll come back and talk more about in November. Thanks very much for listening.
We do have time for a couple of questions. We do ask that if you do have a question, we'll get a microphone to you. We are recording, so we would like to make sure that we include the question, your question, with the recording.
Since Vicksburg did fall the next day, and I know you made a point about we could possibly have two countries if the South had won at Gettysburg, do you see a scenario, though, where if the South had won at Gettysburg, the North still would prevail?
Yes, I do. I do see that. And when you engage in hyperbole like I did, understand that I'm talking in speculation. I'm talking in plausible speculation. I think it's entirely possible that the result of, let's play your hypothetical out, a Confederate victory at Gettysburg combined with the actual Union victory at Vicksburg, what's that going to produce? I think it puts the Confederacy in a much better position to negotiate a peace on relatively favorable terms to themselves. I think a Confederate victory at Gettysburg would have brought the British Empire into the equation. I think they would have attempted to broker a peace agreement at that time. I think Lincoln would have been under extreme pressure to negotiate for a peace, especially if his government has been forced to flee the national capital. I think the result would have been, again, we'll never know. These what-if games, they're fun to play. We'll never know for sure. I think the result would have been a negotiated settlement favorable to the Confederacy. I don't know. Does that address your question? Or what was the other? You were asking, can I foresee a possible Union victory even in that? Yeah. Yeah, you could have. There could have been a Union victory, but I don't think it would have involved emancipation. Certainly not in the short term. We might have 2 or 3 different nations, and they would be a different geographic configuration than we're talking about now. The Confederates might have held on to D.C. and Maryland and parts of Pennsylvania. We might have an entirely different geographic creation or multiple geographic creations. It's a fascinating game to play. It's a very long-winded answer. I think the answer is yes to your question. I think I could play that story out and come up with a way to get to a Union victory.
I've never understood why on the second day of the battle, when the Confederates were trying to turn the left flank of the Union army they went up Little Round Top instead of just going around Little Round Top into the Union rear.
You know, that's as I read the battle reports, as I read the authorities, that's a question that I've had as well. I should have. People get tired of hearing qualifiers and caveats. I understand that. But I am not a military historian. I'll be the first to. I'm more of a political, legal, constitutional historian. All of us that are Americanists, we teach the Civil War. But that would take. I didn't see who I was talking to. I like to. That's a great question. And I've had the same question as the best I can do for you. So I guess brilliant minds think alike. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It would take a military historian to address that in a little more detail, to know the logistics, to know what's available to Anderson and the others at that point. You're right. I mean, it does appear, looking at the topographical maps and the battle plans, that they could have simply moved around. We can speculate about possible reasons, that that's a cowardly way to do it. That's not the way that battles were fought and won at that time. I don't know the answer to the question.
I want to throw one out to you, Dr. Scheer, kind of along these lines. The role the absence of Stonewall Jackson had in this conflict, being the first that he was not there to advise or be with Lee, how significant was that with Gettysburg?
Well, that's an issue that people have played with many times, too, and whether Jackson would have taken the same had advanced the same thought process as Longstreet. Basically, Longstreet steps into Jackson's role at Gettysburg after Jackson is lost at Chancellorsville, as you've indicated. And so people have debated, well, would Jackson have advised Lee differently? Would Jackson have been able to persuade Lee not to do what he did on the third day, whereas Longstreet could not? Again, we're engaging in speculation, and I know that's part of the game, and it's fun. But I think the best answer, the answer that I think is most defensible, would be that Jackson probably would have supported Lee in his determination to go forward with the operations on the third day, because Jackson was simply a very aggressive field commander. You can also make the argument that maybe things might have gone differently on the second day. Had Jackson been there as well. And that was something that, for the rest of you that are not familiar with, you know, this part of the story, I wasn't even able to mention that while the Chancellorsville is generally regarded as Lee's greatest victory throughout the entire war, it was a very costly victory for the Confederacy because Stonewall Jackson was killed in a friendly fire accident, actually, he was shot by his own men and lingered for about a week and then died of infection. From the wound.
All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, can he tell it like he feels it or what?
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. Continuing our presentation of the museum's four-year-long series on the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, we've heard the first of three talks on the year 1863. Our guest speaker has been Mark Scheer, Associate Professor and Chairman of the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. The title of his presentation was The Path to Gettysburg. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, April 30th, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Listen next Monday, February 17th at 12 noon, for the second in this series of lectures on the year 1863. The guest speaker will be Danielle Battisti, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. Her topic will be the New York City draft riots and the boundaries of anti-slavery sentiment in the North. Special thanks to Patty O'Brien, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.